Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast with no lines and no height restrictions to ride. It's April 11th, 2019, and Kirk can finally change his PlayStation Network screen name. We have some suggestions. For the past 6 days, I've been playing a very special massive multiplayer live-action role-playing game called Disney World. Meanwhile, Jason's latest perfect game is Phoenix Wright, and Kirk is still mainlining Sekiro. After our discussion of Jason's big story about Dragon Age 4, we wrap up with off-topic talk about great TV pilots and Kirk's music pick of the week. Let's hit it! And welcome back to another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. I'm Maddie Myers, and I'm also joined by my co-host, Kirk Hamilton. Hello, Kirk.
Hello, Maddie.
And you know what? We're also joined by Jason Schreier. What's up, Jason?
Hello, 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 hello.
Hello.
We're all here. We did it,
we
guys.
Are.
Another
it's nice
week.
To see you for another week to see the two of your smiling faces. Well, Jason, your face is slightly obscured by your microphone, but I'm assuming that you're smiling.
Yeah, always. Kirk,
just
before,
a huge smile.
Before we jump into video game talk, I see in the show notes here that you wrote the following. I'm just going to read what you wrote, which is, "Cable management, baby. An exciting day for Kirk."
It's the title of his new picture
book. Would you like
book.
To elaborate on that?
Sure. Those are two separate things, actually.
Oh.
I will begin by saying...
I assume they're linked because cable management... Like, I assume you're
linked
you're
by
gonna
a cable,
like, well,
right.
I spent
that must
my
be managed.
Entire day right. managing cables.
A very well-managed cable. No, I just wanted to say that I'm feeling pretty good because I managed all the cables in my home office, aka home recording studio, which... If you run a home recording studio, especially if you mic up some drums, you get a lot of cables everywhere. And it kind of, I've always had a pretty complicated cable situation under my desk, but I got in there, I pulled a bunch of stuff out. It's sort of like weeding. You know, when you like weed the front of whatever somewhere and you come up with this huge amount of weeds that just were in there. And it's kind of a nice feeling. I kind of wind up with a big pile of cables, pull them all out. I like use some twist ties and put the cables together.
Did you also find some weed?
I did not find any weed, just metaphorical weeds. And so that felt very good. And now my cables are very organized, which also feels very good. So.
But that's different
spring
than
cleaning.
Exciting day for Kirk.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Exciting day for Kirk is today, at long last, is the day that I can change my PlayStation Network account name.
Oh,
and I'm very
true.
Excited about it.
Yeah, that's
true.
Exciting.
It hasn't gone live yet.
What are you going to change it to?
Oh, I know I'm going to change it too, but I'm not going to say on the show because I might have to get a variant of it. Uh-huh. I think that some people could probably guess, but I won't. We're not going to guess. I'll probably tweet what I change it to, or we'll talk about it next week. Mm-hmm. It's not live in North America yet. I've been sort of like refreshing the page to see when it goes live because I'm very excited to do it. As people who listen to this show and or followed my work when I was writing for Kotaku, I talked quite a bit about my terrible PSN name. And
you should
excited.
Tell everyone what it is and why it is that.
I'll tell it one more time since it won't be my name for much longer. It is IDPL_MAL, which are the first initials of the modes of the major scale, Ionian, Dorian, Phrygian, etc. And yeah, real bad.
And of course you're changing it to Donglord 420, finally.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, something much more dignified. And I will be honest that Donglord 420 is, I think, more dignified
is
than
it?
That terrible...
Is it?
Yeah, because it's trying less hard. It's just that the modes
it?
Of the major scale thing is trying so hard. Donglord
in
is in some
way.
Ways... Yeah, maybe like when Donglord really meant you were trying to tell people that you were a Donglord, then you were trying hard. But I think
and
that at
you
this
were
point,
super chill about it. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. At this point, Donglord is so ironic that it might be good. Actually, Maddie, you've guessed the name that I'm going to go with.
You know what? You could just go ahead and throw out whatever you're going to change it to, and pick that one, although I bet it's already taken.
You just put a bunch of X's. It'll just be about how many X's I put on either side of it. Eventually,
at the end of the X's, you put the year in which you were born, and then naturally, you're good to go.
And the year has to be sometime after 1990. That's very important. Like 1996 or something like that.
What if it turns out that Don Lord is actually the names of a different scale? Like the...
the Don Lord scale?
It's an like some sort of ancient civilization used those letters to demarcate their scale and...
Right, anyway. And I'm like an even worse music hipster about it.
What if one of our listeners has the screen name Donglord420 and they're super creeped out by this entire conversation and and are like, they're talking about me and my embarrassing name. Shout out to whoever you are.
Yeah, I mean, really, super way cool to lock name. That name
super
down.
Badass.
Yeah,
name.
Good job.
Congratulations to Donglord420. why don't we get into it? Because we have a lot to talk about today. Kirk, congratulations, first of all. I'm very proud that you get to finally change your name.
I'm excited. Hopefully it'll work. Don't congratulate me too early. I'll feel good when it's actually done. I'll believe it when I see
it. You can change it, but it only works in most games. There's some games where it won't work.
Like it'll show your old name still, and you just have to accept that reality.
Sure. There's a couple where it'll like break your experience, but they listed the games, and it's only about 8 games, and the only one I think I have is Little Big Planet 3, and I don't know. I don't really care.
So my understanding of this whole thing is that the reason that it took so long is because they had to go through each game individually in order to go and fix it, because the way that there was some way that the PSN database was originally set up back in 2004 or 5 or whatever, before the PS3 launched, where instead of just coding in variables within each game as the PSN name, it's like actually a string of characters that is actually corresponding to your game. So when you play that game, it'll save your string of characters that's attached to your name. So it can't just be easily changed the way that a variable could. So if it said variable char name as opposed to the actual printing your name. So that's my understanding of it. And if anyone listening to this thinks that I'm wrong or getting the technical details wrong, let us know. But
I'm sure that they will. If you've gotten that wrong, I'm sure that someone will tell you each game individually,
and that's why for whatever reason, if the code was too complicated to actually fix it for some of those other games, when I first heard about that, I kept thinking about the poor engineers at Sony who have to go through every single game and fix it. Although I do know that they were telling developers that they had to like accommodate for this over the past year, and that's actually how we got the scoop on PSN name changes coming, because they were telling people like, okay, prepare for this. So yeah, it's interesting times, and you'll have to let us know if it actually works, Kirk, and if you get any weird bugs. Why don't we get into some games that we are playing, because there are lots of games. Maddie, you went to Disney World last week.
Okay.
And I think you should talk about the experience that is not just going to Disney World, but also going to Disney World after you've played Kingdom Hearts 3 all year.
Right. So, you know, great intro. Video games we're playing. I went to Disney World. That is a video game of sorts. I guess I can answer that question by saying I went to Disney World. I went to Disney World for 6 days, which is exactly the length of time between recording split screen episodes. And so I really didn't play any other games between then and now, other than, I guess, Pokemon Go the entire time. I'm still playing Pokemon Go.
So quick question. Disney World is in Orlando and Land is in California.
Yes.
So you went to the one in Florida.
I went to the one in Florida.
Right?
It is the biggest one. And so I had like a travel day on either side and like some quick Disney excursioning on those travel days. But mostly I did all 4 parks on the 4 days. So Magic Kingdom first day, Animal Kingdom second day, Hollywood Studios third day, and then Epcot on the final day, which was a really possibly insane way to spend 4 days of my life. And
what are each of those? So
I went
to school in Miami and never went to Disney World. So can you maybe break down just
so
really quick what each of those 4 are?
I've never been to any Disney theme park at all. And I'm not a theme park person. I don't do theme parks, much as I am a Kingdom Hearts fan. And I refer to Disney parks in my life because I think I know what they're like. I'd never actually been to one. Mm-hmm. The most I'd ever done was like Six Flags as a kid and Water Country and those kinds of things. So this was just like a life experience I wanted to have at least one time.
Yeah.
And my two adult best friends who I've known since I was like 12 years old are major Disney fans, possibly even more so than I, but also Kingdom Hearts fans. And so the three of us went, and it was very much like us regressing back to our childhood together as in this really weird environment. But it was very fun, and it definitely felt like a situation where we needed to have an adult and didn't have an adult, and we were the adults. But anyway, Magic Kingdom is definitely the most emotionally intense of the parks and the most corny of the park, so it was kind of a good park to start with. It is the park that I think of all Disney World as being like, but it's not. I didn't know that until I got there. I didn't understand that there were all these different parks or how any of them worked. But Magic Kingdom is like, there's Disney princesses everywhere. There's a parade with like a big band playing, and Mickey Mouse is there, and like the Mad Hatter is coming up to you and offering you tea, and like all of this in your face Disney parks RPG is happening all around you. There's castles,
right.
But they're
LARPing,
like
basically
slightly smaller than real life castles in this, like all of the buildings feel like just ever so slightly smaller, but in a sort of uncanny way. And everything in the world is designed. So like every ride that you ride on, the queue is designed to entertain you as you go. Like, you know, there'll be a Little Mermaid ride where Scuttle will tell you jokes while you're waiting in line, or like people will, I don't know, interact with you during a ride. And I don't even know where to begin to describe how
really
intentionally
terrible.
I mean, no. Okay. So I'm going to try not to sound like an ad for Disney World here, but they do some things that are very clever now, which is they have this magic wristband. It's called that. It's called a magic band. It's not literally magic, but you can program fast passes, which basically just gets you on a ride immediately. And you only get like three or four of those a day, depending on various circumstances. And so you can be like, I know I want to get to these three rides when I'm at this park, so I'm going to set up these fast passes at these specific times. And
oh, interesting.
You can do that, and fast passes sell out really quickly, obviously, but like, well, sell out quote unquote, but you have
like you
to
have a certain
dibs.
Number and you have to
right,
claim
exactly,
them.
Exactly, exactly. And so if you know you want to take the Tower of Terror or Everest, which is like this really, really cool roller coaster that everybody wanted to go on, then you go ahead and you set up a fast pass for that. You make sure that you're on it. And so like we did fast passes for like Splash Mountain and just stuff that we knew there'd be a really long line for. And there were still some things that were so popular that we didn't get a fast pass for them. But yeah, so that's pretty cool. And the magic band also is like how you pay for everything at Disney World, which reduces lines because you just tap this band.
That's
and
smart.
Then also it is terrifying because
right.
you can spend
it sounds
money
like a very different
easily.
Disney World than the one
yes.
that I went to like 25 years ago.
And also, like, even the lines themselves aren't that bad because there's a Disney World app now where you can just see how long the line is at every
oh,
single
cool.
ride
that's
and every
great.
Single park.
Considering
so you can
like,
just
that's,
look at it.
Sounds like
the
totally
narrative
gamified
about Disney World.
They have
Disney
completely
World.
Gamified it. And so I was explaining this a little bit in Kotaku Slack this morning, but they've also literally gamified the parks, whereby every single park has multiple games that you can actually play. Like, through the app, but also just in the real world, sometimes not with the app. Like Magic Kingdom has one where there are all these portals around the park, which are just like TV screens that show you like certain Disney characters or villains that you fight against using like actual physical cards. And the screen can read what kind of Disney characters on your card and what its attacks are. Like they're like magic cards. Like they have like, you know, attack powers and such
so
and such on the
like
card.
Like that Kingdom Hearts GBA game. That
yes.
was the card game.
Like as soon as we got the cards, my friends and I were like, it's Chain of Memories. Oh my God. And like just being idiots. So we didn't really do much of that. We just wanted the cards because we wanted to see what they were, but we're a little too old to do that. It was mostly like kids playing that game. But we did play the Pirates of the Caribbean game just for the sake of playing it, which is that you can get these treasure maps and go around the park and like tap your wristband on seemingly mundane objects according to the map, and then it'll set off certain things. Like a cannon will like emit a
that's
bunch of dry
so
ice
cool.
and like
this
a voice
like
actor.
A blast. I kind of want to go to
Disney
cool. World
now. Yeah.
So you guys had
and
a
like,
really good time. It's
yeah, it was pretty great. And so after you complete all the treasure quest maps, you go back to this location and they give you a fast pass for the Pirates of the Caribbean ride, so you can just go ahead and immediately get on the ride. So that's your treasure is your reward. And we weren't even going to ride that ride, but we were like,
right.
we have an extra hour in between two other things we're doing, so let's find all these treasures and then ride the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. So we did that, and it was really fun. I mean, I don't know, it was just great. So
yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah,
that idea of giving the fast pass.
We should do a split screen trip to Disney World.
I don't know. I don't know if you guys would like it because it's.
Oh, I would love it. Are you kidding? I would love it.
You might. So I think you might like Animal Kingdom, which is basically a huge zoo, and Hollywood Studio, which is like all the Star Wars bullshit, a little more than Magic Kingdom because
yeah,
that was my experience.
World. Did you do the Simpsons World at all?
No. So I think Universal currently has the rights to The Simpsons. There's like this weird rights question with that world right now. But I didn't grow up watching The Simpsons, so I don't even care about that
stuff.
And
there's also
sadly.
Going to be a Nintendo World at some point in the next few years. So
that'll be our real excuse to go. The split screen field trip, I think, with the Nintendo World, right?
Cool. Well, did you play any other games, any non-Disney games, or
no.
That's it for you this week?
No. I'll just quickly mention one more thing, which is that at the hotel room at night, we were playing this card game, which is the Disney Family Feud card game, and it is completely terrible but like utterly hilarious. Like, it's a card game that my friend found at the dollar store, and we were playing it like as a joke, and it had, I don't understand, so Family Feud works in such a way that you're supposed to guess things that are according to what the most popular suggestion to a question is. So it's like, you know, what goes on a sandwich, and then like a huge percentage of people say cheese or turkey, and you're supposed to guess the most popular answers. So for this Family Feud game, we have no idea how they come up with what the most popular answers were, but they basically seem to be based on like what 1 6-year-old thought the answer was to every question. And
so it's like, who's the best Disney princess
themselves.
It's Ariel, like that's
yeah,
just
like
the answer
stuff
it's
like
Ariel.
That but it's like, how could you have known it was Ariel? So the questions would be stuff like, which Disney princess is the best one to help you with your homework, and like the answers would be based in nothing at all. And so it became hilarious because we were just trying to come up with other clues to help each other guess what the actual answers would be. And I just wanted to say what my favorite question from this card game was, which was, which European capital would Goofy be most likely to move to? Which is just the most absurd question I've ever heard in my life.
Should we guess and you'll tell us the answer?
There were like 8 answers and it was like every European capital. I think Paris was number one. It was like,
so it wasn't like a joke based on words he says or something like that.
It was just
like Paris.
Brussels and London. And like, it was like, what? Huh. I don't know. Anyway, it was a really fun, stupid game that we enjoyed. I had a great time. That's what I did all week. And I caught a lot of Pokemon.
So I want to make sure, before we move on from Disney, I want to make sure I understand what all the parks are. So you said Hollywood, that's like movie stuff, like Disney's movie stuff. So there's like Marvel stuff there or whatever.
I didn't even mention this, but like I have a friend who works for Disney World. Like, she works there and she sews costumes. So she's in the midst of sewing all the costumes for the Marvel World that they're going to make. And talking to her was the coolest thing ever. And she also told us all this sweet behind the scenes information. Like, for example, on the floats, they have princesses who are super high up on these floats, and they're like, you know, rocking around, dancing on the floats, leaning over, waving, and you're like, oh my god, they're gonna fall and die. But they have these like bicycle seats that are on a stool that are like underneath their dress that they like strap into, so the girls up there can like fling themselves around and never fall. And like, she was telling us all these fun facts like that about basically the game design of Disney World, and like, it was so cool to go around the parks with her and hear about that. And like, yeah, the Marvel stuff is probably going to be super cool, and hearing about how she was combining all the different costume styles of each character from the movies to create basically one canonical Disney World costume per character was also like a really cool design challenge. So
interesting.
It'll be good.
That's cool. So then the animal one is like kind of like a zoo, or
it's like a huge zoo, but there's also like rides. I mean, so there's a safari where you can just see real animals. Like, it's interesting because like Disney owns all this like conservation land. I didn't know any of this at all. I'm sure it's like a tax offset for them because of how environmental drain
altruistic
these parks are.
The reason that they have
I mean. I'm being a cynic by assuming this. I don't know. Maybe they're just owning all this conservation land and taking care of these animals out of the kindness of their hearts. But yeah, they have all these zoos, and Animal Kingdom is divided up by continent. So you can see like all the animals from Asia in this one huge area, and then all the animals from Africa in this one huge area, and then America, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like every park is so freaking huge. I was getting like, you know, 25,000 to 30,000 Fitbit steps a day, and my feet are now
ash. So I don't know. That's what the parks are like, Kirk. I don't know if you'd like it or not. It's extremely overstimulating.
I would love it. Oh no, I mean like I would absolutely say Epcot, without reservation.
Epcot is Disneyland, like all the different countries.
Yes, Epcot is like that, but it's not every country in the world, and I don't understand how they pick the countries that are in Epcot. And I kind of was like questioning that on the fourth day, and just being like, why do you guys have like Norway but not, I don't know, Belgium? Like, I don't know. Maybe someone's going to write in and tell me there is a Belgium and I just missed it. But yeah, it's definitely not every country in the world. But they have all these booths for countries and you just eat food and look at things and play more games and ride rides.
Cool. Well, Disney sounds like fun. Let's talk about some video games, shall we?
Please do.
Sure.
That's what this show's supposed to be.
Jason, what are you playing?
Yeah, so I'm playing a bunch of stuff. I've been playing a lot more Baba Is You. It seems like, I don't know if you guys are still sticking with it, but
oh yeah,
I've played like 130 something of the missions and of the levels, and I keep discovering that like it keeps getting bigger and bigger. So there's this little thing you could do. I don't want to spoil anything that happens because it's so clever, but you kind of you feel like you might be heading towards the end, and then it turns out you're not. It turns out there's a lot of other stuff, like in you know how there's a big world map that you see when you first whenever mm-hmm. you are in the game, there's more than just that stuff. I'll just leave it at that.
That's awesome.
But then once you get to these new kind of worlds that I'm talking about, there are also new words that come into play and new mechanics on top of that. And it's all insane. It's such a wild game. It's gotten to the point where like I have to just stare at levels for a solid hour before I can make any sense of them. So I don't know how, I don't know if I'll be able to even just beat all of them without, because I've been playing entirely with no hints, no looking up solutions at all online. I don't know how much longer I'll be able to do that, but it has been a thrill. It's definitely my favorite game of the year so far. And then I've been switching on my Switch between that and the Phoenix Wright trilogy, which I talked a little bit about last week, but have played a lot more since. And my goodness, what a video game series that is. It's incredible. I'm up to case 3 in the first Phoenix Wright and holds up extremely well. Still the perfect video game. Anyone out there who has not played them, get the Switch versions because they're really
good. Did you just call Phoenix Wright the perfect video game?
I was going to say, yeah, like, man. Should we be making a running list of every time someone has described something as perfect on this show?
I want to remember that the last time we talked about this, it was me saying I've never called a game perfect. And
I know.
Never. And it always ticks off my perfect radar when someone says that.
I'm just going to throw this out there. I will happily call any video game perfect. I don't have a problem with hyperbole over here.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it's just an excellent series. Hilarious and charming and super fun. And the Switch version, something that I've noticed since jumping into it and like committing to it, is that they've done a lot of quality of life improvements. So this is pretty granular, but in the DS version, you couldn't actually speed up the text until you had beaten the case, and then you could speed up the text afterwards. Now you can just speed it up. And also,
Was it in the DS one where you could can you skip through conversations that you've heard after the first time you've heard them, like when you're listening to testimony twice, or was that not until later? I remember there was a time where you have to listen at like regular speed, and then when you're going through it multiple times looking for the contradiction, you can speed along.
That's what I'm referring to. You can just you can just speed up the whole thing and skip the whole thing. And then also they do this clever thing that was added in like the fifth or sixth Phoenix, right, where in investigation mode, once you've checked something, it'll give you a little check mark so you don't have to worry about clicking the same thing twice, and you can know once you've actually found everything there is. So a little quality of life stuff like that is really good.
You know, a thing from Phoenix Wright that I think Phoenix Wright was the first series where I noticed this, though a lot of games do this, is I've always really liked the way that the writers of those games use unspoken text that gets filled out with a little sound effect, you know, like as it fills out, and the various speeds and lots of little clever tricks to be really expressive, like to have like a character will speak super fast and the sounds will move super fast, or it'll go really, really slow and it'll sit there. Like they have a lot of great comedic pacing delivered through those
It's a Super Nintendo trick that it would change tones based on the voice of the character.
The character speaking.
If you ever play the game.
Does Phoenix Wright do that?
Yeah.
It does. I think I can remember.
Maybe not. No, I could be wrong about that. But
I thought
it was maybe
just pacing. Because like Undertale does that super right? Like,
well, so the first game that I remember doing this is Lufia 2, which is the Super Nintendo RPG. And I remember this very distinctly because the tones would be this higher pitch, like for female character, and then for a male character, it'd be like more normal baritone, like. It was really cool, and it was like prototype voice acting before there was voice acting. It was tonal differences. So I've been playing that, and highly recommend if you're out there and you haven't played them. Switch is the perfect opportunity to jump in. And then I've been playing this other game that we haven't talked about called Zanky Zero, and I'm willing to bet that most people haven't heard of this game because it hasn't gotten a lot of attention or buzz or press, because it looks weird. It looks like anime trash, basically. And usually these games with weird titles and anime trash, like, there's no reason for most people to pay attention to them.
Uncontroversial statements by Jason Schreier.
But you know what
his
I mean.
His Twitter like, handle always... is at Jason Schreier.
Well, okay, so for example,
his display name is
you know
Anime
how
Trash.
We're always getting press releases about like the latest One Piece game, and there are always five of them a year, and nobody really cares except for Mike Fahey, who always.
I think
just...
some people care, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get like 300 emails from all the people who care, but
being
yeah.
Like, that's my favorite game series.
Anyway,
which, you know, fair enough.
The reason that I paid attention to Zanky Zero is because this is the next game from the Danganronpa people. This is the next game from the developer. Of Danganronpa, a series
is that, Spike Chunsoft?
All three of us very much enjoy. Yeah, but Spike Chunsoft is a big publisher. They have a bunch of different teams. This is specifically the Danganronpa team. And so I've been playing it, and it's really friggin' weird, and it feels like a Danganronpa. It's like basically a new Danganronpa game. Except here's the twist. It's not just a visual novel. It's like half visual novel, half like weird action RPG thing with survival elements. And it's very, very slow and true Danganronpa style, so I played for like a bunch of hours and I barely scratched the surface of the actual gameplay.
Barely scratched the surface?
Yeah,
sorry.
That's just classic.
I had to do that. I had to invoke Monokuma.
Oh yeah.
There's an animal, bears. Right? Didn't you say there's an animal in this
there's,
game?
So there's this like little baby sheep and his assistant who's a little boy, and they both like chime in on this television and talk to you and say creepy things and are weirdly sexual and make all this sexual innuendo. It's basically Danganronpa. It just
but
feels a lot
sheep.
Like Danganronpa.
Okay.
And there are eight of you on this island, and everybody has this unique personality. It's 100% Danganronpa. Like, if you like the Danganronpa games, this is way up your alley. I haven't played enough to like really get into the meat of the story, because the biggest problem with this game is that, unlike Danganronpa, it's not on any handheld systems. It's only on PC and PS4. And so I've been playing it on my PC, but like if this was on Switch, I would be playing it all the time, because these types of games, like plot-heavy, visual novel, text-heavy games, are designed like should be on handheld systems. That's what they are meant to be played on. So I haven't had as much time to play this thing as I have liked.
That sucks. Yeah, I'm looking. It looks like it's on Vita in Japan, but not here.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe that means it could come to Vita here.
Well, hopefully it comes to Switch. That's the hope.
Yeah.
Because like
that would be ideal.
Spike Chunsoft is also releasing a new game from the Zero Escape director, the guy who directed 999 and Virtua's Last Sword and stuff. And that is coming to Switch. So hopefully this one comes to Switch also. But yeah, it's cool from what I've seen so far. I don't really understand the gameplay. It's weird RPGs. There's a lot of numbers and stuff, but the actual mechanics appear to be just like standing in front of a monster and mashing a button. So I don't really follow it yet, but maybe as I play more, I'll get more into it. But yeah, Zanky Zero, it's a weirdly titled game. I think it just came out this week on Tuesday. So if you're interested at all, you can already check it out. But yeah, if you like Danganronpa, so far from what I've seen so far, it just feels like a lot more Danganronpa. Kirk, what about you? Nice. What are you playing?
I played a lot of things. So first of all, at game night this week, we played more Root. I had heard from a lot of people who were happy that I talked about Root, some people who hadn't heard of that game. This is a tabletop game I played. I had described how it works on a couple episodes ago. So if you want to know that, listen to that. But this time I played as the Vagabond, which in this game, everybody's very different. Each of the competing people have super different rules and different. It's almost like you have to play it four times to even understand how it works. And the Vagabond is the one who's totally on his own and can kind of make alliances with other people. And I played just really mischievously.
What was the animal? Squirrel? Rabbit?
I was a raccoon. You can choose your vagabond at the beginning. There are three possibilities. There's one, it's like a fox or a wolf, and it looks a lot like Geralt of Rivia, and I wanted to be that, but I was the thief. And anyway, I played pretty dirty and sort of exploited my fellow board game night players, and won. I totally won the game as the Vagabond, which is a really, especially winning as a Vagabond requires you to be pretty crafty. So I feel bad about it, and like they'll maybe never trust me again, but it was super fun. So that game is just fantastic. I can't say enough good about it. That's called Root, and it's really good. Video game wise, I played a lot of Sekiro in the last week. So that's still my main video game. And I'm pretty far in that now. I've beaten a bunch of bosses. I've like picked up a whole lot of things. I think kind of about to make the next major story shift. And yeah, it's a really good game. I really like it. It's really big. It feels just super big. It in some ways is kind of smaller, I guess, than Souls because it doesn't have like all that online stuff and there isn't as much complexity to the character builds and all that. But it's really deep for how focused some of the character creation stuff is. And yeah, it's really good. It's been interesting. That boss, Jinichiro, the really hard one that everybody gets stuck on, there hasn't been anything that hard since then. Hmm. Like, it's not to say the game is easy. It's not. It's, you know, hard, but but nothing has been that hard. I haven't hit any major roadblocks. Like there have been bosses, I've beaten like on the first
because of Gunichiro.
But do you think also be because you beat him, and so now you know certain things about the game that you didn't before?
Yeah, somewhat. It also, yeah, I think in some ways you get better at fighting and you learn how it works. Like that's like a really brutal tutorial, and just don't run away. But at the same time, no, also like some of the bosses are just like Souls bosses almost. They're really big. They kind of have slow wind-ups with their attacks. And your guy can just run forever because there's no stamina. So really, you just run in circles around bosses and hit them. Like the bosses that I've fought Souls style or Bloodborne style have felt really boring compared to Jinichiro, which was this totally different, really wild. And like you have to just be so on it and reactive. That was pretty cool, and like the combat in general is really great, but some of the bosses that I've been fighting are just much bigger and kind of less interesting actually, because I'm not as constrained as I would be in a Souls or Bloodborne game, so it's sort of easier to just kind of beat them without trying too hard. But really what I like about these games, what I've always liked about Souls, is exploring, and the exploration has been really cool. And it's the same thing where you just go to some freaky new area and there's all kinds of weird stuff going on and you're getting tricked and trapped by the game. It has such an amazing sense of humor. I think it's such a funny game. There are these various jokes. I've been sort of tweeting a few of them. There are these guys that jump down from the sky. This is a bit of an early game spoiler, I guess, but I think it's safe to talk about these guys at this point.
Everyone's seen the kite dudes on Twitter.
Yeah, they're just in like, that's such a perfect example of the kind of joke that From designers really like to tell, where it's not just that there's a guy hiding there and it's not just that he kills you. It's like where it's placed in the level. It's the fact that you see a kite earlier and there's nobody on it, and so you just think there are kites and it's no big deal. It's exactly like the sound he makes, the way he lands on you, the circumstances, the way they've built the encounters. First you fight one guy on the roof, then two guys, then you have to fight two guys at the same time, and as you're fighting them, then suddenly you hear this like wah sound coming in and you're like, what the hell is that? And you just get creamed by this dude who just comes out of the sun basically, and it's so funny. And there are a lot of funny jokes. There's a really funny boss later that's like kind of a Dark Souls joke, and there's a really weird boss encounter that's like almost not a boss. I won't say specifics. So anyways, it's a very funny game. I'm just finding it to be really just full of sort of life and interesting ideas and good humor and challenge, and I'm really liking it.
Very good.
So more Sekiro, and I'm sure I have a ton left. Given that it sounds like the final boss is like stupidly difficult and it just gets so hard, I could see myself maybe not finishing it, but at the same time, I've come this far, so we'll see how it goes.
Maybe it'll seem easy to you when you get there.
Maybe, not based on what everyone I know who's fought the final boss has said. They've been like, it's some bullshit, but we'll see.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people saying, and maybe we should table this until we've actually had a chance to play it, but I've seen a lot of people saying like the final boss isn't even satisfying. It's so annoying.
Yeah, that and it really, like, there just does come a point if something's that hard that it's like, okay, I got what I needed to get out of this game. I can already tell I'm approaching a narrative choke point, and like I'm in the middle of the part, and it's kind of after Jinichiro. You get a bunch of, it's sort of like in Dark Souls, you know, they give you those objectives after a certain point in the game. They're like, and now you must go and get these items. I don't remember what they're called. Mm-hmm. And in Bloodborne, it's sort of like after you've beaten Bloodstarved Beast and what's her name up in the chapel, it kind of feels like it opens up and you have chalice dungeons and you're going into the woods, and then you can go to the other woods, and then you're going to the castle, and it's like, wow, I have all these places I can can go, that to me is always the best part of these games. And it does always end. It just has to. And then you get to the point, like in Bloodborne, you're kind of going through all these dreamscapes, fighting bosses. I don't like that stuff as much. And in this, I can kind of tell this is coming to an end and it's been so cool. You know, I've played like 40 hours. That's been great. If it comes to an end and it channels me down a bunch of really challenging stuff that I'm kind of not feeling, I'm fine with just being like, okay, I got the best part of this, or the part that I liked the best. So I can move on. So we'll see though. Maybe I won't feel that way. I've played a little bit more Division 2, which is such a funny game. It's a game with no story, as best as I can tell. There's basically just not a story. You're just a person, and you're in Washington, D.C., and there's like a narrative framework. You know, you're a division agent, whatever, you're fighting against bad guys. But there's no story that I can tell. I've kind of played a fair amount, I guess, and it's really interesting. Like Destiny, you know, a similar kind of game, tries to have a story. Warframe has a story. Like some of these like service games, there's a story. There's a bad guy and they're taunting you and you're kind of like, oh, we have to fight the bad guy. Whatever. They give you some framework for what you're doing. Division just sort of doesn't. It's like, I'm sure there's some general guy, I guess. But so that's kind of funny. And I don't really care. It doesn't detract from the game.
It's important that it not be political.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's fun though. It's like fun to play. It's gun exhaustion. So I don't have been playing that much because you just eventually it's like, oh my God, just gunfire constantly is a little overwhelming. But it's really, as a cover based shooter goes, it's a very lively game, I think was the word I kept coming back to. It's very lively. Like each fight, the guys are constantly coming around and flanking you and pushing you around. And there's a guy shooting grenades at you and he's really heavy and just walking and you can't really hurt him. And then suddenly you're getting flanked and they're yelling out to one another. There's a feeling of sort of liveliness to every encounter that I really, really like. And, you know, it's not, I won't play that much. My only other thought on the Division 2 is that I've been playing it really casually. I was looking at the Division subreddit, which I rarely read, but I just thought I'd look at it. And people are now, you know, way into endgame and they're complaining about stuff now. It's like, oh, well, you know, they need to change this and you need to rebalance
that phase
this
in the life cycle.
It's like anything. Like it's like any service.
Yeah, people haven't been complaining at all until now. This week they finally decided to start. Yeah.
Well, it's in the Division 2, it's funny. I don't know about this week, but it is like when it launched, this is the thing with any service game, right? When it launches well, if it's like Anthem, it's a little different. But if it launches well, there's kind of a period where people are happy and then people start to run out of stuff to do. And you're seeing the complaints from the really hardcore people who've like seen everything, just like it was this way in Destiny over and over and over again. And so it'd be like, oh, you really need to fix this like arcane balance thing on this one type of gun. Or like, I can't believe they're nerfing this like one random type of exotic weapon that no one has. And that becomes like this flashpoint of debate. Where in the Division, it's like the way I'm playing it is I've played like 12 hours and I just sort of casually play a little bit. And I'm kind of getting the perspective of what in Destiny there were a lot of these people, like people who would just kind of casually play. Like we'd occasionally meet them, or they'd be like, you know, mutual friends of me or you, Jason. And they're like people who have a couple legendary guns and just play sometimes. And they're not like going and chasing everything down and then running into these end game walls that the really hardcore people do. So it's been kind of fun to play the game like one of those people and to kind of have that experience for a change. And so I've sort of enjoyed that. And let's see, the only other thing that I've played is I started playing Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines again. I'm still hoping the two of you.
Yeah, we should play it, right?
I think it'd be really fun to play through it together. It has not aged well in some ways and it has aged really well in others.
So it sucks, but you want us to play it? Cool.
Oh, no. I don't mean, no, it definitely doesn't suck. It's funny, like it doesn't even work on modern machines without this patch. I'm not sure about that. It doesn't work on my machine.
Okay.
But there's a patch. There's this patch that people have spent years working on, and it's like this amazing crowdfunded patch or crowdsourced patch, that all these people have worked on. That's really incredible and does much more than just make it run in widescreen. It like, I think they've restored lost content and rebalanced the game and fixed a whole lot of bugs that were in it. So it works pretty great, actually. And there's something that makes me very nostalgic about turn of the century PC games like Deus Ex and this one that have this certain look. The textures are all stretched and everything's like really sharp, but there's not a lot of detail. And it just feels very like that. And that kind of just makes me like feel warm feelings when I'm playing it.
So I and, will say I downloaded Warcraft 2 from GOG because it just came to GOG for the first time, like digitally available mm-hmm. for the first time. And playing an old game like that is like, it's nostalgic for the first few seconds. And then you're like, oh my God, this game is just hard to play now. It's just clunky. I wonder how much of that is, and that's not the case with all old games. So I think it just depends on the game. Because I've also played Baldur's Gate 2, which wasn't too many years after Warcraft 2. And that game has aged like beautifully, like fine wine. So I guess it depends on the game.
Yeah, I mean, Vampire was never like the picture of polish, and it has a lot of issues. Like, I guess I've never finished it. The back part, there's like a lot of forced combat that I guess is mm-hmm. annoying. The combat isn't good, but it's like a Deus Ex game or like, you know, Fallout or something. Like, you can play a lot of it with like using conversation and persuasion. There's a lot of going around and talking to people, and that stuff is all really fun. Like, it's well written, and the voice acting is really good, and it's a cool world. I mean, the world of Vampire, that you're like this cool vampire who's one of these, you know, clans. I don't know if any of you have ever played that role-playing game or know that world at all, but it's pretty cool, like, as a setup for a game. It makes me really psyched for the new one that they're making. But no, I think that it will hold up in some interesting ways, and I'll probably keep playing around with it. We'll see.
Maybe you'll finally beat it, since you just said you never did.
Yeah, maybe. But I gather that it doesn't... I don't know. I don't think that finishing it is really the point.
Maybe I'll play it and not beat it.
I'm just amazed that you have so much time to play games, even after not being your job anymore. You're still I'm playing this.
Well, Root is... I mean, I don't know. Tabletop is different. Sekiro has been kind of an exception. I've played that more than I've played everything else. Most everything else I'm playing like super casually, like just a little bit. But Sekiro has definitely pulled me in more than any game.
It's hard to play that game casually also. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can
that's
play
the thing.
It casually.
Right.
It's a commitment, like we talked about last time. All right, why don't we take a break and then we'll get into a news-heavy week.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, it is time to talk about the video game news of the week. Why don't we start by talking about Dragon Age, since last week we talked about Anthem. So last week, I guess over the past few months, as I've been reporting on various Bioware things and just hearing whispers and stuff, I've heard a lot of stuff about Dragon Age 4, and I put all of that, or the bulk of that, into an article that went up on Kotaku this week, so you should go check it out. It's about the past and present of Dragon Age 4. And just to give you all the really short version, Dragon Age 4 was in development after Inquisition and then Trespasser, which was the DLC to Inquisition. Quick side note, by the way, Trespasser was apparently amazing. I didn't play it. I don't know if you guys
I reviewed it.
Oh, you did.
I reviewed it for Kotaku. You didn't link to my review in your article, I noticed. Wow. Thanks for that.
I forgot that we had reviewed it. Well, the tangent I was going to go on was that there's this crazy, like, I guess the saddest bit of irony in the video game industry is that the DLC for games tends to be really, really good just in general. Like when a team has already, because the team has already, they've like figured out what their game looks like. They know how it plays. They have their tool set like all established already, so they don't have to spend any more time building their editors and tools and whatever, and their pipelines for production. So they know how to make the game, and then they can just focus on making something that's like super good for the next time around. So oftentimes we'll see these incredibly good pieces of DLC, but they'll come out so long after the game, 6 months, 8 months, a year after the game, that most people have moved on to something else. And so they all sell really poorly, like a fraction of what the original game sells, or because most people never finish the original original game and so never can play the expansion. And so it's just this sad reality where like people love making DLCs and feel like they're really high quality, but nobody buys them. It's tricky, right?
I don't know. I think about the Citadel DLC for Mass Effect, which I think I also reviewed, and then Trespasser, which was very similar. It was along the lines. And I think they almost explicitly set out to do it, which both of which, it wasn't just that they were better at making the game because they knew the tools. It was also that they had this kind of completed story to work with, so they could take all the unresolved threads, all the existing relationships that they built up over the course of the game, and then like have this big celebration of them, which was great. And you kind of, it almost has to be a niche thing, or I mean, it's at least for anyone who finishes the game, because, you know, by design, it's taking everything that was in the game and turning it into something else. So there's really no way around it. I guess it feels special that they're able to make those things at all. Mm-hmm. And that Trespasser, you know, was able to exist. Trespasser was a little different, I guess, than Citadel, because it also set up Dragon Age 4 at the end, because it ended with Solas. I believe Solas is the Trespasser. So like it kind of sets that up in a way that Citadel was much more of a just grand send-off for all those characters.
Right. So let me get back on track to finish what I was saying before, before this tangent. So as you were saying, Trespasser set up Dragon Age 4, and that's what this team, who is creative director Mike Laidlaw and executive producer Mark Darragh and a bunch of their other leads, Patrick Weeks and Matt Goldman and John Epler, like all those people who are just longtime Dragon Age people, they immediately start working on Dragon Age 4, codenamed Joplin, because BioWare has this tendency of naming their codenames after after 80s, 70s singers. Dylan, Janis Joplin. Yeah, it's funny. So they're working on Joplin. They're all really excited about it because Mark Darragh and Mike Laidlaw get up in front of the team and say, hey, what we went through on Inquisition with like all of the challenges, the technical challenges, the production challenges, us struggling to find this vision, that cannot happen again. We are not going to go through that again. This time we're going to do things right. We're going to have this consistent vision from the very top, and we're going to work with that. And we have all these pipelines in place from Inquisition that we're going to start using. And we're just going to do things right this time, right? Which is their goal. So for the next couple of years, they're working on Joplin. There's a big hiccup where they all have to stop working on it for a few months to finish Andromeda, Mass Effect Andromeda, because that game was a mess. And if you look in the credits for Mass Effect Andromeda, you'll see the Dragon Age Finaling Team, which is a funny thing to see in any game's credits. And it's a list of all those people who had to stop working on Joplin, Dragon Age 4, and come work on Andromeda. But then they all go back to work and they start bringing on people for Mass Effect. They're all really excited. Suddenly, it is the end of 2017. Aaron Flynn, BioWare GM, has left. Casey Hudson, who was the Mass Effect director, came back to run the studio. And one of Casey Hudson's first big decisions, presumably made in conjunction with EA, is, hey, Anthem is on fire. We need all hands on deck for this, or else we're never going to finish it in time. So we need to pull off all these people. And so they wind up canceling Joplin and rebooting it under a new codename, Jim Morrison. At that point, Mike Laidlaw was the creative director. He leaves. Some other folks who were on that team wind up leaving. A lot of them go to Anthem. They all come back to Morrison after Anthem is done. So now-ish. And now we are at the point where we have this new Dragon Age 4 that is probably not going to resemble, or maybe it'll resemble. We don't really know. I don't think they even know. Part of the crux of my piece was that the Dragon Age team tends to change things a lot during production, and I'm sure a lot will change based on this. But the thing that I think has a lot of people worried, including some people who are in BioWare or who were at BioWare, is that the new focus is not just single-player RPG, it's game as a service. And what that means could be a lot of things. It could be an online-only game where you play most of it single-player, but there's also optional drop-in, drop-out co-op and like some other multiplayer mode. It could be an online game that's like pretty heavy on multiplayer, and maybe you get incentives for playing multiplayer. It could be an online game that's single player and just total separate multiplayer modes, sort of like Dragon Age Inquisition was. But what we do know is that it's being built on Anthem's code base. So all the Frostbite tools and engine that they've developed already, they're using this time, rather than starting from scratch the way that BioWare has for their last three projects. And we also know that it's got to have some sort of long-term revenue plan, because that's what EA is all about these days. Got to monetize for the long haul. And I also think that part of that equation is BioWare saying, hey, look, we want people to actually stay engaged with this game so they wind up playing our DLC story drops and whatnot. So I can totally see a game that's like, even if it's heavy single-player stuff, which it very well could be, where it's like 2 weeks after launch, we're going to drop a story pack and then another story pack a few weeks later, rather than having these big DLCs, maybe it'll be a smaller stream of stuff. Or maybe it'll be like, and this is an idea that I heard floated around within BioWare circles, who knows if it'll actually be in the game, but it could be like, if enough people across the world do this quest, then it activates the next part, like sort of MMO style, like large scale stuff. So it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, some of these ideas could be really cool. Although when you hear live service, you think, oh my God, like fucking EA and their chasing of FIFA for every single game that they make. So yeah, so we Dragon Age 4, the short version is Dragon Age 4 is pretty far away. It's in development right now. We probably won't see it for another 2-3 years. At least, and it'll definitely be live service unless EA like looks at all the negative reactions and is like, okay, let's change things around this time. So we don't know a lot about what it'll finally look like, but it's been a struggle for a lot of people there, and I think there's hope from some people that now that this stuff is being talked about, kind of the tough conditions that they've had to work under and the stress and the anxiety and the depression, there's hope that it'll lead to BioWare making some changes for the long term, which hopefully that happens. But just as a huge Dragon Age fan, I'm kind of sad about some of the ideas that didn't make it, and hope, crossing my fingers, that Dragon Age 4 will turn out to be a good single-player heavy game.
Yeah,
same. Is that what you want, Jason? A single-player heavy Dragon Age game? That's what you're rooting for?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want fucking multiplayer Dragon Age. I like some of the ideas. Like, I like the idea of... I wouldn't mind if it's online only. Like, I don't care that much, and I'm pretty sure it will be, unless they wind up building some single-player branch of Frostbite on the Anthem engine that's like that lets you play offline. But I think people would be fine with an online only version of Dragon Age 4
people as long as they could play. Would be, yeah,
that's true. But as long as they could play by themselves, like that's the most important part, that you can play the entire game without anyone bothering you, which was supposed to be the case for Anthem mostly, but the game just pushes you to play with other people every single time you try to load up a mission. It's like, are you sure you want to play by yourself? This game is meant to be played with other people. So yeah, I don't know. I'm like cautiously hopeful. There's certainly a lot of veterans like from the Dragon Age team who are still working there and still working on that game, so who knows. And I don't know what's going to happen, and yeah, I'm hopeful. But some of the ideas that I heard about, and I heard about some stuff that I didn't wind up reporting just because I didn't want to get into all the nitty-gritty, especially because some of it might actually wind up being used for Dragon Age 4, but some of the original ideas were just really cool. Like a lot of stuff about that's like systemic narrative stuff, by which I mean story mechanics that don't necessarily have to be handwritten. So like you go up to a guard and you can persuade them to join your side, and it's all kind of part of the gameplay rather than just specific cutscenes that are written for each scene. And this was all on paper and in prototypes, so who knows what it would have actually looked like in the game. It's easy.
Yeah, I mean, that's narrative Legos, right? I feel like that's something that people who make video games have been talking about for years and years and years, totally. And no one's really done right yet.
Well, some games have done it well, including 80 Days, and also
but that stuff is all written. Like, that's still all written. I guess imagining something different based on what you're describing.
I guess what I'm imagining is more mechanical stuff that like winds up driving your personal story, but mm-hmm. I don't know, it's all theoretical at this point, or it was theoretical when they were talking about, like, who knows how much of it actually would have made it into the game. But it sounds like they have their production pipeline like really, like they have this idea that was like, okay, we're gonna have this vision, we're gonna stick to this vision, we're gonna communicate, we're gonna know that making the second best decision is better than not coming to any decision at all. And that's the thing that's saddest, I think, is that they were all, the people who worked on Joplin that I spoke to, at least, were all really excited about the way that that was headed, and that was taken away from them, and they were forced to work on Anthem, which was this game that was totally disastrous and really difficult for a lot of people. So I think that was really tough for those folks, and so hopefully Morrison, the new Dragon Age 4, sticks with some of the lessons that they figured out, and hopefully a lot of this coming out in the open allows them to talk about it without feeling like they couldn't. Like, I think one of the reasons that a lot of people wanted to talk to me in the first place was that they felt like they couldn't talk at work. So yeah, it's ongoing story. Why don't we talk about some other news?
Sure.
So this story is fucking hilarious. This is a Destiny story, so I apologize to those of you who are like, oh, you guys talk too much about Destiny, but it's actually funny for anyone who doesn't play Destiny also. So Destiny has this guy called Xur, and he comes to town every weekend and he sells a rotating selection of items. Last weekend, he sold a weapon that was PS4 exclusive, which the problem was he sold it to Xbox and PC players. And so they found that they could get this weapon that they couldn't get before. So Bungie posts patch notes on Tuesday, I believe it was. They post this this message on their forum saying, hey, we accidentally allowed PC and Xbox players to get this weapon. If you bought it, for now you'll be able to use it, but when we put up the new patch, this new hotfix, you won't be able to equip it at all. It'll still stay in your inventory, but it'll be locked and you won't be able to use it until September. So if you bought this weapon from Xur and you're on PC or Xbox, you cannot use it until September. You have to like put it in your vault, use some of your precious vault space to hold on to this weapon that you can't actually use because Sony has paid Activision and Bungie to deprive players of a weapon. Side note, there's so much anger and rage from gamers about the Epic Store buying exclusives. Why don't we see? We don't see quite as much rage about this.
Just I have an answer for that, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I think that this is it's funny. I think this is a funny story to people who don't play Destiny. But if you do play Destiny, I actually haven't seen any really anger from Destiny players about this because people knew the deal. I mean, I've definitely seen anger from people about Sony locking down exclusive stuff just because
that's
a bummer and nobody likes that. But this specifically, I mean, clearly they just screwed up and they have some contract with Sony. I mean, I'm supposing that they do, that this is the case, mm-hmm. that they have a contract with Sony and they have to honor it. So they're like, well, shit, we have to come up with something. We can't let these people keep this because we signed a deal that's like a major contract or something. So that's their solution is actually kind of clever, like that you get to keep it and you can look at it. And you say precious vault space, but come on, there's like a ton of vault space. Like, give me a break. This is not some huge imposition on people who don't have one of like a bajillion guns in a game with a bajillion guns. So it's funny, partly because I saw a comment to this effect under our post about it, or under Kotaku's post about it, not our. And that is, one day I'm going to stop doing that. And then it was someone being like, this wasn't even the biggest thing Bungie screwed up this week, because there was this other exploit related to enhancement cores where if you got one of the pinnacle guns that like you can earn through these, you know, really elaborate quests, I think it's if you get the gun you can just pull it out of your collection and just dismantle it and you get 7 enhancement cores every time, and those cores are really really hard to get.
Yeah.
And so those cores are like central. They're very controversial right now for hardcore Destiny players, the mm-hmm. people who are, you know, trying to infuse a bunch of stuff because it's
weapons,
expensive.
Yeah.
They let you infuse your
gear.
And so so it's funny that that actually is the thing that Destiny players give a shit about. They're like, this is like a stupid exploit. Some people were able to get thousands of these things that we've been complaining about not having enough of for, you know, months. But now the rest of us feel left out and they're going to patch it. And there's this whole other like thing that's like a really granular, hardcore Destiny thing that actual Destiny players are angry about. This is more of a funny soundbite to me. So it actually is interesting. Like this from the outside seems like maybe this would be more of a big deal. But when I'm looking at actual Destiny players and thinking about playing the game, does anybody really care about not having an exotic void trace rifle when there's like other trace rifles and no one really gives a shit and where it's gonna unlock in September? It's sort of just a funny
just a funny story. Well, it's just the idea that Sony is paying to like deprive
it's a reminder,
people of content,
right? Yeah.
Like it's not like it's just the way that they're going about it is not like, so when you think about the parallel between Epic, which is making a lot of people mad, and I still don't really understand why people are so mad, but whatever, let's say you like Steam, you don't want your games off of Steam because of all the features that Steam provides, and maybe you don't even trust Epic with your data, whatever it is, whatever your reason is for being mad, like the fact is that you don't have to spend anything extra. All you have to do to get that game and the same exact way is just download an extra launcher. As opposed to this, where in the case of this weapon, it doesn't really matter, but there are actual maps and strikes and stuff that Sony has paid money to deprive from people, which is like, when you think about it, like, just think about the logic of that. It is so fucked up. And, like, not enough people are just, like, railing against Sony for doing that. Like, they are literally, they're positioning it as, like, this is for you, PlayStation fans, like, for the gamers. But really, it's just taking things away from other people.
I mean, I think people don't like that and have railed against it. But how long can
for
you
like
rail
ever.
Against something
yeah.
that's just happening? Like, you can't, totally eventually, fair. It's like, well, I like Destiny. I don't want to be mad
Epic,
about this
it
constantly.
Seems like they can rail about it every single day.
Well, the Epic thing is new. And also with Epic, you know, I don't know. Like,
people
it's,
have attachments
have the
to, like, their Steam achievements. Like, there are
yeah,
people
it doesn't have all the features.
No, I get that. No, that's what I was saying before, that I totally understand that. But at the end of the day, you don't have to spend another $400, $200, whatever it is on a PS4 to just to get that stuff the way you do with this. I'm not saying that either of these things is necessarily good, but the Sony paying for exclusive DLC is like, it's always rubbed me the wrong way and really
yeah. I'm curious if now that Activision is no longer involved, because presumably that was a deal between Activision and Sony,
yeah.
So I wonder if Bungie, given that Bungie seems very like attuned to players and what the players want, they're kind of constantly giving people what they want. This seems like this would be an easy way for them to score points. Easy if, unless the money that they would be getting from Sony is like super, super helpful, or it's a lot of money, which could be the case. I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. I heard that that Bungie wanted to do character transfers for PS4, PC. Remember when we talked about that a bunch last year before Forsaken came out, but Sony wouldn't allow it. Sony is just like, we want people to associate Destiny with PS4, and even if that means screwing over other players. But yeah, it sucks, and hopefully Bungie ends it. All right, one last news story. This is a good one. So inside of The Division 2, there is a poster. I don't know if you've gotten this far, Kirk, because I think it's pretty far in the game. It's in this area that's it's like a big theater center sort of thing, like an art center.
No.
And
I'm doing museums. I'm going through all these museums. Lots of cool museums.
A lot of museums in DC.
Yeah, turns out.
So there's this poster, and it's got this like Norse traveler or Norse god or something, and it says Valhalla on it. And what people discovered was that if you look really, really closely, he is holding an apple that looks exactly like an apple of Eden from Assassin's Creed. And so people interpreted that as a tease for the next Assassin's Creed game being a Vikings game. As it turns out, many months ago, I heard that the next Assassin's Creed was going to be a Vikings game. So either this is Ubisoft teasing yet another one of their future games inside of a game, which is one of those cool, fun things that they've been doing for a while, or it's the world's funniest coincidence that someone stuck this in there without knowing, or like just thought it would be fun, or someone went rogue. But whatever the case may be, we now know, and I guess I now can confirm, because I didn't want to be the first one to just like spoil the news or whatever, spoil their announcement and do it yet again. But I felt in this case that I had to confirm that, yes, we are going to Vikings. Are you guys excited to play Assassin's Creed in Viking time, in the Viking age?
I mean, actually. I like yeah. Vikings.
This is 2020, by the way. I should clarify. So this will be next fall. Just
I'll
in
play
time
it.
For next-gen consoles. Yeah, I'll play
like
it, too.
It.
I'm excited.
Vikings
like
always had,
like,
female warriors, too, like, in real life. So
yes.
Let's hope for that.
Yeah, new Cassandra. Well, I mean, after Cassandra, though, they're definitely after this last game, I feel like they're definitely going to do.
But I don't want to hope too much for that. I do love a female playable character in a game, though, I got to say.
Yeah,
nice.
Well, and Cassandra was one of the best characters that I can remember in my life.
So I hope they continue with that, or they could even do
totally.
A thing where only a female character is playable, but I know that would be such a big risk. Oh.
Or I guess it would be the opposite of ballsy.
They save that for the Vita games. That's which you can now play as
which
Aveline,
count?
Is that
they
her
count?
Name?
Yeah,
yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And she's now in the Assassin's Creed 3 like remaster, which I definitely don't have time for that much Assassin's Creed, and also didn't like Assassin's Creed 3, so I'm not going to play that.
Yeah, I kind of
yeah. I think a Vikings game would be good. Have either of you watched that show Vikings?
No, I've heard it's
TV
good though.
Show? Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I played God of War.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
heard of
I've
it.
Heard of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, you guys. Yeah,
yeah. Vikings is pretty cool. It's like a I think it's an AMC show. It's pretty historical. I don't know how fully accurate it is. I watched a season or so, and it definitely gets into a lot of Viking traditions and the fact that Vikings were sort of a really cool society, despite also being a pretty like brutal,
bloodthirsty society.
Like they do a lot of horrible shit to people, but also they have some really interesting laws. And I would definitely play an Assassin's Creed game set there. But let's be
very
real,
bloodthirsty series, so it seems fitting to have
right.
a Viking.
And I mean, I would play an Assassin's Creed game set anywhere. So
yeah, sure.
I'm an easy mark when it comes down to it.
Well, especially now that the series has gotten so friggin' good with all the RPG stuff that
they were always good.
They've iterated on it until
let me correct that statement. They've made it way more tailored towards what I like in video games, and that makes me very happy.
I agree.
I wonder if they'll stick with that RPG stuff, since there were definitely some people who don't like that stuff.
I think it's likely
given the way that it, you know, speaking of single player and Dragon Age being a sort of an online service type game, that seems the way that Ubisoft is doing Assassin's Creed, it's too much for me. It's just too much. The enchilada is too large. I cannot finish it. But it's quite an enchilada. They have been regularly refilling the enchilada with delicious filling. So,
that would be a clever way to do a Dragon Age game. Although I don't know if BioWare has the resources of that. I mean, the team that worked on Assassin's Creed Odyssey, including all the new stuff, is probably three times the size.
Well, it's like multiple studios.
Sure.
I mean, there are entire Ubisoft studios that make just a section of the game for an Assassin's Creed game.
Yeah. So I think that's the biggest problem when it comes to just like doing that sort of live service.
I wasn't really making any predictions about BioWare. More just saying this model does appear to work, though. Right, it clearly one huge difference is that it requires literally multiple game development studios working in tandem. Though I guess BioWare does have multiple game development studios.
But it's not quite the same. I think a lot of them have looked with envy at Ubisoft and said, "How the hell do they make this work with their teams all across the globe?" Because BioWare, over the past few years, has had so much trouble making it work with the multi-studio system, and they wound up having to close their Montreal studio because they couldn't make the three studios system work. And then even today there are all sorts of tensions between Edmonton and Austin, in that Edmonton like looks down on the Austin people and they kind of feel like they're the true BioWare, and there's a lot of complicated stuff there. It's interesting. It's this idea of like a game as a service as like the one game that you play and the one you keep going back to, and how Assassin's Creed Odyssey might be single player, but it can still be that one game that you just play all year long.
To zoom this out, can you picture, given that Assassin's Creed is itself narratively built around a framework of plugging into an animus device that allows you to travel into the lives of all of the various protagonists of Assassin's Creed, that eventually Assassin's Creed could become the ultimate service game in that you basically are able to access any of a variety of storylines across time, and it really just becomes
and
a thing where
new ones.
You just cycle through every assassin.
Yeah, like the in-world version of animus tech that people use for entertainment, essentially, you're not an animus, you're playing a video game, but essentially becomes that outer world framework. I could kind of see them doing that. I guess they're kind of heading in that direction anyway.
So the one hiccup there, I would think, is that, like, so imagine this idea where you buy Assassin's Creed, and then, or you download Assassin's Creed, the launcher, and then within that, like, and it's like this animus, and you're walking around in your computer, and then
there could be like a whole
games.
Story that you're kind of piecing together through Easter eggs that people are
and then you buy
like
each
in
game,
the launcher?
Right? But then
or
you
like
buy
just,
each game.
Yeah.
So it could be like the Uplay store. I mean, the biggest barrier here would be the amount of the file sizes, because you would have to like download each thing as a separate game, right?
Sure.
And it would turn into, so imagine that combined with this, what Ubisoft is very much adopting, which is game streaming, and like them working with Google Stadia to do some crazy like thing where you don't have to actually download things because you're streaming the games, and so you enter the animus and then you're streaming a game. Like that's the future that I bet they would
part of it.
Freaking
that,
love.
Yeah, I mean, they're practically doing that. And the more I think about it, there is a connecting macro narrative that connects through all of Assassin's Creed beyond even just the story of the like progenitor race and stuff. It could be it's kind of interesting. We'll see where that goes.
So the one thing that I wanted to add about the Vikings thing is that I really hope that they go full on mythology the way they did with Odyssey. And
they absolutely will. 100%. Come on,
Or Loki.
Yeah. Or Zeus. I mean, we didn't fight Zeus in God of War
either.
Zeus is
the Greek one, though.
Right. Not Zeus. I mean, Thor.
Weirdly, Zeus will be Thor. There.
Yeah. God of War has just scrambled my brain when it comes to mythology. Yeah, no, they've gotten them all in the same stew. I just can't keep them
straight. Maybe we'll have a crossover. Because there was a Kratos reference in Odyssey. So maybe we'll have a crossover in Norse mythology, yeah, too.
Maybe.
Isn't there a cave you find that's like the Cave of Kratos or something? I remember that in Odyssey.
That would make sense.
So we're running a little long, but I do want to get through a couple of quick questions. So maybe we can just read through these real quick. Maddie, you want to read this first one?
Sure. So this is a question from Chris. This question is mainly for Jason, but I'd love to hear all of your thoughts as journalists or former journalists turned musicians, but still podcasting on the side. I just read Jason's excellent article about the Anthem development process, and I am once again amazed by the amount of inside information you were able to dig up. My question is this: when working on investigatory pieces like this, do you ever worry about sampling bias? To take the Anthem article as an example, my concern would be that only the employees with the worst experiences at BioWare would want to break their confidentiality agreements and speak to journalists about their time at the studio. This isn't to say that those people's experiences don't deserve our attention on their own, but I'm curious about what steps you take to ensure that you're getting an accurate and complete picture of the companies/projects/experiences you investigate. So Jason, how do you do it?
So this is an interesting question. I wanted to answer this on the air because it's a pretty good question and because I've gotten it a few times before. So just real quick, I mean, the easiest answer is that when someone tells me something, I'm probably not going to publish it unless I also hear the same thing from another person. It's very rare for me to print something that I've only heard from one person, and when I do, I'll spell out that I only heard it from one person as opposed to from multiple people. Another thing that I try to do is be very careful about what I'm allowing people to say anonymously. And one of the reasons I want to talk about this question is because the idea of having to do these stories entirely or almost entirely based on anonymous sources is something that I've struggled with for a long time, because that's not the ideal in journalism. Ideally, in journalism, you want to print like entirely people getting quoted with
you
their
say
names.
Anonymous sources, but there's a distinction between an anonymous source and an unnamed source, right?
Yeah,
the anonymous unnamed. Always
okay,
implies
yeah,
to
unnamed.
Me.
No,
okay, yeah,
we never print anything based on sources where we don't know. Yeah,
right.
Oh, yeah.
That's
but
a crucial
no,
distinction.
So,
I think people don't always they use the words okay, interchangeably, and I think it's an important distinction to clarify that.
Sure.
An anonymous
fair
source
point.
Is when someone just mails you something,
right.
And it shows up at your doorstep, and it's like got all this incriminating information. You don't even know who it's from. An unnamed source is what you do. You don't ever
yeah.
publish anonymous tips, right? That you just get from someone who's like, I'm not
right.
going to tell you who I am, or as far as
right.
I know.
Well, in the BioWare case, I actually did get an email from someone who was like, I can't tell you
disguising
who I am.
Disguising their identity.
But
yeah.
I don't wind up using that stuff in
right.
the story. It just helps corroborate other stuff. So if someone
right.
says that anonymously and then... I don't want to get into weeds on there. What I was saying before is that when it's not ideal to use anonymous sources because they can use anonymity to kind of let their gripes out and just go hard against people. And so some of the things that I try to do are like be careful about printing subjective things based on anonymous sources, especially allowing anonymous sources to trash other people who are named. And it was this whole ironic thing because, as you guys remember, BioWare put up this blog post that they wrote in response before they actually read the article that was like, we're not going to participate in this because it names names and we don't believe in that. And the article did wind up naming a couple of people who were on the leadership team, but a lot of the stuff I heard was like stories about those people or like quotes about those people that are like, this person was cruel to me, this person was horrible to me, this person made me cry, this person did this, this, and this. And that's stuff that I didn't wind up including either because I felt like it would be unfair to include it without hearing their perspective or because it would potentially identify that person as a source. But regardless, the point is that when you're using anonymous sources, and this is something that I wind up having to check myself on often and talk to Steven about and stuff like that, you just have to be super careful about making sure you're not letting someone anonymously just vent to you all this subjective shit that like may or may not be true but is like probably going to be exaggerated in some way because we all like to exaggerate about our stories and our lives. And yeah,
never, I tell all my
really
stories
careful.
Totally straight. I never exaggerate.
Yeah, anything. I know you don't. I know. You don't. Yeah, well, for you, it's all about the details that you don't use.
Very true. Very true.
But yeah, no, it's a lot of it's a good question because there's a lot of thought that goes into it, and there's a lot of like sausage making behind the scenes stuff that I think is pretty interesting. Why don't we talk about a couple more? Yeah, sorry. All these questions are about this article, and the reason that I wanted to bring them up this week is because saving them for another mailbag would not feel timely.
Let me read this one. Can I read Ian's letter? Yeah. Ian writes, "Hello, Team Split Screen. I've been reading Jason's wonderful articles and book on studios like BioWare, Rockstar, and Bungie. It really made me reflect on the games I have been playing. My question is, are there any large-scale developers or studios that you can highlight for having really good working practices? Maybe they could serve as a model for the other companies. If nothing else, it would be nice to play a game and know it wasn't built on an overabundance of blood, sweat, and pixels."
So this is another interesting one. So this is also something I've been thinking about because people kept coming to us and we got a few emails that were like this and we're like, hey, can you guys spotlight some companies that are doing it right? And I keep thinking about this and thinking about, like, is there a way to do that? And I think the catch, and I think that what every single PR person in the world is probably thinking right now is, like, even if I feel at my company that, like, most people have healthy work-life balances and we're doing it right, if there's a chance that someone like Jason could come in and find a couple of people who are like, yeah, I had to work 80-hour weeks for this whole project, then it's like, we don't want even want to, like, allow the possibility of that happening. So part of me wonders if, like, the people are just not going to even allow that to happen. But I will say, I mean, I mentioned Ubisoft last time and Insomniac because I've heard some good things about both of those companies. I also think, so believe it or not, EA has a studio called EA Dice in Los Angeles, not to be confused with Dice in Sweden, but the Dice in Los Angeles, they have installed this, like, we do not crunch under any circumstances policy. And I think they're more of a support studio than, like, a we are making original games thing, which makes it a little bit more convenient to be able to do that. But that's actually the studio that, I don't know if you guys remember the whole EA spouse thing back in the day, but that was the original, like, bombshell, like, expose of working conditions in games. And that was that studio, EA in Los Angeles. And so since then, they have, like, made huge efforts to be like, we don't crunch, we are super accommodating and, like, work-life balance, et cetera, et cetera. So there are definitely some out there. I think there are also studios in Sweden that I've talked to people who work at and are just like, yeah, because of Swedish law and, like, the way that people treat, like, labor here, we just have it a lot better and we all get long vacations, like 3-week summer vacations, and then that's on top of our PTO and stuff like that. So there are studios out there doing it right. I would certainly like to spotlight them more, but we'll see in the future if we can get those stories on the site. Have you guys heard from people that you talk to about, like, studios that are doing things right in the video game industry?
I mean, like, usually the smaller end of the scale, I hear from people that Double Fine is okay. I have a friend who works on the Caves of Cude team, and she's always saying they are a really great team to work for. But it's like, those things can change. Like, sometimes you have a great manager, sometimes you don't. But it's always nice to hear from people.
Also,
and we interviewed the Night in the Woods developers on Switzerland at GDC, and they sounded happy. But I mean, there's always examples of sort of smaller teams that can make it work. I still optimistically want to believe that these studios with hundreds of people can also find ways to make it work. But I guess that's more rare or more difficult.
Well, even with indie, I feel like sometimes it's even worse because you're financially invested and, like, creatively invested, and you're like, I want to put every extra hour into this thing. And so it can become, I mean, a lot of the time when we talk about crunch, it's this insidious thing where it's, like, all voluntary. It's all just like, I want to be there, even if it means destroying myself, because I want to make sure this game is incredible.
Right. Right. Which is sort of a different can of worms than the one you're describing with these larger studios, where maybe that feeling is felt by some employees,
but totally
not always.
No, it's totally the same at the large studios. No, I mean, if you talk to, so Naughty Dog, which I talked about last
week. I think it's different, actually, if you have, like, hundreds of people who are socially pressuring you to crunch, and at that point it actually is difficult for you to say, I really want to be a part of this, as opposed to being in an indie studio where you feel more involved with the project you're making because it's smaller. I mean, that actually is, like, a different social atmosphere creating that crunch. It's not wildly different. I'm just saying it's somewhat different.
Yeah, although the social atmosphere can certainly be the case, even if it's just four of you in an office. If you're the only person leaving at 6 p.m., you can still feel this.
Yeah,
it can be even more so. And also, I think that, I mean, what I've heard from, like, people at Naughty Dog, for example, is that a lot of people are just like, I want to take ownership over this thing because I'm at Naughty Dog, and I take pride in that. I like want to make sure we're making the game of the year. So yeah, I mean, it can come in all shapes and forms. And one thing I want to add is that a lot of people interpreted the BioWare Magic stuff and like the whole Anthem production stuff as an issue with crunch. And I just want to elaborate a little bit that crunch is certainly a part of that, but a lot of the issues and depression and anxiety didn't just come out of crunch. It came out of people feeling like they were in a toxic work environment where they felt like they weren't listened to by their managers and their goalposts kept changing, and they felt like they would be singled out or like that they couldn't speak up. And there were a lot of issues there beyond crunch. So just to elaborate on that. Okay, cool. Why don't we take a break and then we'll go back with some off-topic stuff and Kirk can give us some muzak.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we are back, Maddie and Kirk. What are you guys watching these days, or reading, or listening to, or park going? Park attendant.
Yeah, I did a lot of non-video game activities this week that I could go on and on about, and already did. But the only other thing is that I started watching Golden Girls, which is a show that I have actually never seen. There's a lot of TV shows I missed out on because TV just wasn't really ever watched in my house growing up. And I don't know, it's a really good show. The pilot for Golden Girls is really good, guys. Like, it's really funny, and it's all on Hulu, and I just recommend it as like a really tight, amazing sitcom that exists.
It's a good show. I've watched some of it and like would love to watch it from the beginning. As some of our friends out here are really into Golden Girls. Golden Girls is kind of in. We actually got for our friends as a gift. We were at Target looking for something else and found sort of abandoned somewhere in the home decor like area this just Golden Girls trivia game that was like $1, and we bought it just as a goof gift, and we still have it.
Better or worse than the Disney Family Feud game?
When you, it's funny when you mention that, it made me think of the Golden Girls game. I was like, that sounds kind of similar.
I gotta find that Golden Girls game.
So, but it just trivia can have like objective answers,
right? Exactly. As opposed to Family Feud, where it's like, why would you even try to make that a card game? Right, it's completely impossible.
But that makes me want to watch even the pilot, since we're TNG is like our old show that we're watching, but just watching the pilot seems like it'd be fun because it is a wonderful show with a great theme song.
Yeah, and also pilots are so hard to make. Like the Cheers pilot is really famous for similar reasons, in that it just sets everything up so perfectly. I don't know. I kind of like watching good pilots sometimes.
I agree. I love TV show pilots. That's the whole thing. Like I'm with you. That's cool.
Can I geek out about The Sopranos for a second?
Sure. Can you ever?
The Sopranos pilot was shot, I believe, a year before the show actually
came out. Yeah, everyone's so much younger.
And if you're a hardcore Sopranos fan, it's like insane. It's surreal to watch.
Totally weird, yeah.
A, like, he's the boss of the family, even though he's not actually the boss once the next episode starts, because there's a whole lot of other stuff. Jackie, who's the actual boss, is not in it even. B, Silvio Dante, who's like his consigliere and best friend on the entire show, is portrayed as someone who's not even in the mafia in this first one. He's just like an extended friend of the family. It's just so, it's got so many bizarre elements like that, where it's just like,
and
one
just
of the
James
main
Gandolfini
characters is a
looks,
different actor.
He really looks more than a year younger. He looks like 5 years younger than he does.
A lot of stuff happened to him that year.
He didn't like put on his Jersey accent until the next episode. So that's really weird. And yeah, he's a lot skinnier. He like gained more weight for the role. Some of the characters have different actors. Adriana Lacerva, who's Christopher's girlfriend in the show, is just a random hostess and like doesn't even have has a throwaway line, but like isn't actually Adriana. There's a lot of like little interesting stuff like that. There's this random ass character who comes into a store. This isn't in the pilot, it's a little bit later, but actually it's this actor who turns out to be Vito, who's a super important character in later seasons, but he's just playing this random civilian in the first season. So yeah, a lot of funny inconsistencies in pilots in general, I would say.
What I like about pilots is that they're designed to sell, obviously they're designed to sell network executives on a show, and so they come at you and they really have to summarize what the show is about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I find that a lot of times, especially when the second episode then establishes, okay, now here's the longer story arc, uh-huh. and TV shows are kind of unsatisfying in a certain way. Pilots almost always contain, you know, are very self-contained, and I've always just enjoyed that. Like the West Wing pilot. Doesn't the West Wing pilot, it ends with like him walking into the room and totally owning this lady, which is of course very Aaron Sorkin-y and in a lot of ways. But it's like so perfectly West Wing watching that. And
it's almost like a good
The Friends
like,
one is good.
It's almost like a good feature article where you're reading it and at the front it's like, here's what this is gonna be about, and then it zooms out and it's like, yeah, start from, you know, the beginning. Here's the story.
It's almost sort of like a game tutorial too. The way like I used to like game tutorials more than I do now, but the first hour or two of a game, because it's sort of throwing everything at you and letting you know what it's about before you get into the longer longer process of the full experience.
For the level
sort of similar.
Start. Yeah. So real quick, I've been rewatching Veep because my wife and I saw that there were new episodes, and we realized we had forgotten a lot of what happened. So we started from the beginning. That is a hilarious show.
It's,
what a good
really
TV show Veep is. And yeah. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is just a powerhouse. Man,
she's
what
amazing.
A force of nature she is. But yeah, just a great show. I haven't watched any of the new stuff because we're starting from the beginning. I see on the sheet that you're watching the new stuff, Greg?
Yeah, you reminded me to add it. I love Veep. I love, like, man, it's so funny. God, I could just, like, watch those YouTube montages of people insulting Jonah forever. We've watched
Jonad.
The first Jonad. What? God, I can't even. I always try to remember the insults, and then I don't do them justice, and they're just not as good. I've watched the first, so there have been two episodes of the new season, which is the final season, and I haven't loved them. I don't want to
I feel like
whatever.
The previous season.
Yeah, the previous
ended
season was
such
not
a,
great.
Well, but it ended in such a final way. I'm kind of surprised there are more episodes. I remember. Yeah. Doesn't it end with like the museum and stuff with her? And I'm vaguely
trying to remember actually. Well, it doesn't. And she's gonna run for president again.
Right,
which is
but
that,
it sort of ended in a way that seemed satisfying, at least to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't know about new episodes of Veep, but I guess I'll watch them.
The challenge is that the writing is kind of the insults. There have been a couple of insults or like a couple of one-liners, because that's the thing that I love about Veep, in addition to the performances, is that there'll just be a one-liner that's so fucking funny, like that's just so twisted or weird or just like makes you realize, oh my god, like who came up with that joke? And it just makes me laugh and laugh and laugh. And there haven't really just been that many of those in the first two episodes. It's been really mean, like, which the show is super mean. You know, it's a mean, everyone's a mean asshole, basically, except Mike. I guess Mike is just kind of an idiot, but everybody else is a mean jerk. And it's partly that actually Mike is like
Richard,
in a different role.
Richard is the best.
Richard,
character.
Right. Richard is great. Richard is also not mean. But it's just, there's kind of like Jonah's running for office, and I don't want to spoil people on anything, I guess, but like Jonah's stuff isn't working. It's like really cartoonish and ridiculous, and like I'm kind of like, oh, this just isn't that funny. And like, so I actually have been a little mixed on the first two episodes. There have been a couple great jokes, great scene between what's his name, Hugh Laurie, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who have like amazing chemistry and are so good together. So the second episode had a really good thing with them that I liked. And I was like, okay, I'm into this.
I liked his
character.
He's
extremely good. And but it's an awesome show. I mean, I'll definitely watch the rest of the season, even if I haven't loved it.
I think the showrunner left a few seasons ago.
He did. Yeah. The guy who made the British show and then left. They were still funny after he left, though, at least for a minute. One of the challenges is that like Washington D.C. is like worse than Veep in some ways. Like it's you know, I mean, everyone says this all the time, is, oh my god, the Veep writers would throw this out for being too stupid, whatever's happening. So, and I'm just a little exhausted about politics. And,
so it's
there's
also
that
like
too.
The situation where Veep started during a very different political time,
right,
and now
exactly.
we're in the one we're in. So I'm sure watching
thing
it feels
that happened
different.
At House of Cards.
Right. Mm-hmm. I'm sure writing it feels different too. I'm sure I know they've talked a lot in interviews and stuff about various creative approaches to that and stuff. So
what else are you watching, Kirk?
Just a little bit more Kids on the Slope, and we're gonna finish it out. It's a fantastic show. I heard from a couple people who hadn't watched it and then watched it after I talked about it, which is really exciting because I love it. I just saw the episode with, I won't say what it is, but it's the episode is called Now's the Time, named for a famous Charlie Parker tune, and is like it's like a really triumphant, amazing episode that kind of weaves together a lot of the music that's led up to that point in a really cool way, and is wonderful. It's a wonderful show.
Nice. I really like it. I just want to say real quick before we move into your music pick of the week that some exciting news for Jason is that the Brooklyn Nets have made the playoffs for the first time in 4 years, and that doesn't seem like a ton of time, but it's really exciting because just a tiny bit of basketball context here is that about 5 years ago, under their GM, Billy King, they made the worst trade in NBA history, where they basically gave up their future in like hopes of doubling down on these aging veterans, Paul Pierce, who I'm sure you guys have heard of, and Kevin Garnett, who were these two guys at the peak ends who were Hall of Famers, all-time greats, but at the ends of their careers, and the trade just wound up falling apart and basically tanked the Nets' future. But somehow the Nets have managed to get back into it and just do this really smart rebuild, and it's made me very happy, especially because the New York Knicks, who are the other New York team, stink and they're just terrible and will be terrible forever. So as someone who loves the Nets and hates the Knicks, that makes me very happy. Nice. Kirk, why don't you give us your music pick of the week?
Okay. My music pick of the week came to me from a Strong Songs listener who wrote in, and their question, it was like a question for a Q&A episode. And the question was, why can't my wife and I stop singing or humming this song whenever we hear it? And so it was essentially a question about earworms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I get a lot of recommendations on that show and I don't always have time to listen to things, but I thought, okay, I'll listen to it. I put it on and I was like, this is a good little song. And so then I wrote them back and it was like, oh, you know, it's a, here's how earworms work and it reinforces the melody, blah, blah, blah. And then I was like, I don't listen to that song again. I went back and listened to it again. And then I found myself listening to the whole album and I just really, really like it. So the music pick is by a singer named, who goes by Sigrid. Her name is Sigrid. And it's from her 2019 album, Sucker Punch. And this is a song called Sight of You. And here's a clip of it. So this whole album is like that. It's very uplifting, high energy pop music. It's very good for running. It's like, you know, every song just sort of has this bounce and really positive thing to it. Sigrid is, I think, 22 years old, and all of the songs are sort of about like
being
smaller
22.
Things. Yeah, like things that aren't really epic or grand, just sort of like, I'm having a bad day and now I feel better, or like, you know, I didn't see that. Like, it's just a sort of a simpler thing that, I don't know, I felt that way sometimes. Well, Lorde was like more complicated because she was very young and writing songs about sort of like young people stuff, but in a way that felt actually sort of like older or wiser in some ways. So Sigrid is very plain spoken in a way that I sort of really enjoy. Sort of one of the nice things about this kind of music in general. But anyway, I'm really into the album. It's like Churches meets the Cranberries or something. I don't know. And it's cool to be listening to an album by somebody from this year instead of something from the 1970s, which is nice. Where I feel like I spend so much of my time.
Sounds great. Yeah. I'll get it. I'm always looking for new running playlists.
I get sick
of my running playlists so quickly. That is the only problem with running playlists. So.
Mm-hmm. They
well,
burn
that's
out.
Why you
well,
have
this
to
is a good
to
one.
Podcast. While running.
Well, nope, doesn't work for me.
Yeah,
no, there's got to be some banging tracks so that I stay going fast.
Yeah, I go back and forth between that. I've listened to podcasts running, but I am with you.
Podcasts are for pumping
so
iron. Music is for running.
So I'm the opposite way because when I don't run, but when I go to the gym and do weights and stuff, I get so bored that I want to listen to podcasts.
Exactly.
To just like
for
yeah,
weights.
No,
yeah.
But that's why I listen to podcasts. Well, you're saying running is different than
weights. Yes.
Yeah, running with music, because running, you have that rhythm and that pulse. It's so fun. I just like running to really good music.
But I get bored running, too. That's why I like podcasts.
I mean, it is boring unless you change up your running playlist often enough that it's songs you're really excited about listening to.
Yeah, I mean, music isn't boring. Like, it's fun to listen to.
Well, it's boring just in terms of
to Jason, personally, who hates music.
Yeah, I don't know. I get more... I'm more like when I'm exercising, I just want it to be done with. So I want to listen to a podcast to just go make the time go by faster.
Mm-hmm.
Jason, you know what might work for you is my mom always watches thrilling TV shows when she's doing cardio so that her heart rate is already elevated and she's
like
totally
horror
engaged.
Movies?
Yes, yes. Or like
really?
TV shows or things like that where like spy shows, intrigue, mysteries, anything like that. That might work for you, Jason.
That's
an interesting
idea.
And anyone else listening.
Strong advice. all right. I think that is it for this week's episode. I will be gone next week. I'm going on vacation, but we will return again the following week. And Kirk, I should say that you and I will be restarting our Game of Thrones coverage.
Oh, yeah, we will be in a little bit. That's going to be a little later than the first episode.
Yeah. So that's people are going to have to wait until, because I'm going to be on vacation, people are going to have to wait until I get back. And then I think we're going to do an episode at some point when I get back from vacation. So at some point after episode 2, you and I are going to get together and we're going to talk about the first 2 episodes and just dive into that. And then after that, we're going to start doing weekly recaps for 3, 4, 5.
I believe that is the current plan.
Yes.
So yeah, I think that's what we're planning to do.
Cool.
That'll be fun.
I'm excited. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Sunday.
Also kind of
it's like this
it.
Sunday.
Yeah.
There's a new Game of Thrones
like
episode
coming
up.
Last season. So I was reading a recap of last season and the amount of like dumb shit that was in that season just makes me so sad. The way that this story of George R. R. Martin's, this incredible story, has just been run into the ground has bummed me out a little bit. And I hope that this season is great. So crossing my fingers. I'm just hopeful.
Hopefully.
All right. See you guys next time.
Yep. See ya.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton, Jason Schreier, and me, Maddie Myers. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR One, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.